Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Single digits and dropping, that's the forecast for the next day or so. If you have children or work for Ohio State or any number of Central Ohio school districts, you've probably been talking about the weather as those districts and OSU have canceled classes today. Coming up, we'll take the temperature at the Ohio State House. But first, joining us by phone to give us the backstory on the cold snap is Ben Gelber, meteorologist, science and environmental reporter for WCMH, NBC4. Welcome back, Ben.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Very well. Very warm. Is it fair to call this a cold snap, or is there a better expression for what we're experiencing?
I think certainly the historic term is cold wave, and I think that would pretty much cover that it's a very extensive blast of Arctic air.
Extensive? Why do you call it? What amounts to extensive these days?
Well, I think when you have the whole northeastern one quarter of the country, essentially the entire upper Midwest, actually maybe even more than that, maybe a third of the nation, but the upper Midwest, the midsection of the country, the Ohio Valley, all the way down to the Tennessee Valley, and that's going to spread south to the Gulf states and then on to the northeast today. So probably a good a third to not quite a half of the nation, but that's a pretty massive Arctic dome.
Are we breaking any records?
Well, we should easily break the record low for today, which is minus five. We'll break that probably by late afternoon, the way things are going. Temperatures have already hit the zero mark over at least the western half of Columbus, and the cold air is just kind of oozing on in. Indianapolis is down to 13 below zero, and Chicago about 16 below. So we have some exceptionally cold air, and I would expect that we'll be generally 5 to 10 below zero by evening rush hour. So we'll probably break the record later this afternoon and then bottom out somewhere minus 10 to minus 15 between dinner time and midnight.
We are talking about the weather on All Sides with Ann Fisher right now with Ben Gelber from NBC4, meteorologist at NBC4. If you have a question or comment, he'll just be with us for the first segment. So 614-292-8513. Now, it seems like it came in slower last night than was predicted. I was expecting snow, hoping for snow by 9 p.m., but I was only starting to see it around 11.
Well, yeah, and a couple of hours in weather is minor because the systems are constantly changing. And it was snowing, for example, in Hilliard by 10 o'clock. It just took a little longer because the storm track was kind of far to the west. I think initially it looked as of, say, Friday, the storm would track over central or eastern Ohio. And often the storms get a little stronger. They wind up veering a little bit to the left of that course, and then the storm track is updated. But sometimes we still have in our minds what the original forecast was. But we've gotten so precise sometimes that we can outdo ourselves and create a little higher expectations down to the hour. But the changeover did occur essentially from 9 to midnight across what we'll call the Central Ohio area. But most of the moisture already lifted north, so we wound up with less than an inch of snow compared to, say, Indiana, where they had 6 to 12 inches and about 4 to 6 inches over northwestern Ohio.
I know that I'm unusual and that I would prefer the snow over the gobs of rain we got over the weekend and yesterday. Do we know how much rain yet?
We had about a half inch of rain, so that would have been a good half foot of snow, which, would have been really difficult to deal with today with all the blowing snow. Mm-hmm. So in one sense, we lucked out that we don't have to deal with blowing and drifting given the 20 and 30 mile per hour winds. So I guess that would be the positive.
Was there any icing of any note? I didn't notice that there was any concern about ice storm or anything like that as it transitioned into the snow.
No, it went straight to snow because of the very rapid drop in temperature. When the storm went a little west of us between Dayton and, we'll say, Delaware, it was literally just to the north and west of Franklin County. That put us in the mild sector. But as soon as the storm got in the north-central Ohio, the cold air just raced in. So there wasn't really a chance for a changeover to sleet or freezing rain. But it was kind of a very quick shift to snow and a quick drop in temperature into the mid-20s shortly after midnight. So it was other storms, are a little slower moving, or the transition zone is wider. But this one was kind of, it's all or nothing. When you have this kind of cold air sitting just behind the storm and the Arctic front, it changes in a hurry. But again, we're lucky a lot of the deeper moisture was already kind of scoured out before the cold air came in, or we would have a completely different situation this morning.
How fast did it change? How do you measure that? How, in minutes, an hour? How do you look at that?
Well, I mean, it literally, again, I can only go by what I saw here in western Franklin County and Hellier, that I saw snowflakes starting to mix in around 10 o'clock yesterday evening. And then over the course of maybe a half hour, it became all snow, although it was fairly light at the time. But it then, it continued to snow. We had one burst between 11 and midnight as the Arctic air flooded in. And then after that, it's just been intermittent snow showers and flurries. And now we have sparkling sunshine, which kind of belies the zero temperatures and minus 15 wind chill.
Okay, I'm in a basement studio right now, so it's nice to know the sun's shining out there.
That might be the warmest spot right now.
Sharon in Columbus, you're on the air with Ben Gelber. Welcome, Sharon.
Hello, I have a question for Ben. A few years ago on the weather broadcast, you explained about why there are these noises in our homes that sound like someone's throwing a huge rock at our homes that has to do with the cold weather. I'm already hearing those noises in my home, but I just don't remember what you said. I was wondering if you could explain that again. And I do remember you said it wasn't a concern, but I would sure like to know why it happens.
Okay. Now, thanks, Sharon.
Thanks, Sharon. Those are the expansion and contraction of building materials in the home itself. We'd have to talk to more of an expert on specifically, which make the louder noises. But I do know just in summary that it has to do with when you have the sharp drop in temperature, you'll have that contraction and expansion process. Also, as we go the other way, as we begin to thaw. So we'll be hearing all kinds of popping sounds. The other issue that we had, I think it was 5 years ago, which is a little bit different, which isn't in our homes but outside, are frost quakes. And that can happen when you get some moisture like we had yesterday with all the rain, a third to a half inch, seep into the ground, and then you can get contraction or freezing and then expansion when that thaws. And those can sound like little mini sonic booms. Well, it remains to be seen if we'll have that. We may not thaw that quickly. But those are two common phenomena that for folks who live in areas that are prone to frigid weather, are more accustomed to, and we don't see these kinds of sharp temperature swings or deep cold snaps very often. So it's more infrequent for us.
All right, Sharon, thanks for that call. How is wind chill determined?
Well, a chart has been created based upon studies initially on how quickly the skin freezes against bags of ice. A study was done in the 1940s in Antarctica. The wind chill index was refined not too many years ago, just like the tornado index was refined in 2007 based on further studies. But essentially, it's the apparent temperature. It's not a real temperature, but it's what the air feels like against our skin, or at least exposed skin. So if you're not bundled up properly, and not to mention, there are many other issues, including breathing can be compromised in harsh cold, especially for those with any pre-existing respiratory conditions, and or those just out of condition. And so it's gonna be a challenge. The wind can kind of literally take your breath away. And we can deal with 0 degree temperatures. In fact, we have already this winter near zero readings. Well, even just this past Friday morning. But when the air is dead calm, it's completely different than when you have a 20-mile-an-hour wind and a 30-below wind chill, which is what we have now, much more difficult, even with the exact temperature, the same reading on the thermometer.
Okay, I'm going to talk to Jim in New Albany. You're on the air with Ben Gelber. Hi, Jim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Mr. Gnall there if he remembers back in roughly 2002, somewhere around there, 2003.
It's Ben Gelber.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Did I say Jim Gnall? Okay.
anyhow, I just wanted to ask him if he remembers it being, I can remember it being.
Oops. that we did lose him, and I didn't do it. But Ben Gelber, do you remember back in 2002?
I definitely remember. I remember the year 2002. I can only surmise if he's talking about historic cold snaps. Really, the one that we'll measure this one up against when it was colder was 1994, and also farther back in 1985. We've had some pretty intense cold waves, which produce temperatures even lower than these, including wind chill factors. But this is definitely, at the very least, once in a decade kind of cold.
Now, what about salt? People say that at certain temperatures, salt doesn't matter anymore. It's not worth throwing down.
Yes, there's not much effectiveness to salt below 20 degrees. For example, Columbus City will use a mixture of calcium chloride, and I know some other counties and other regions of the country use some beet juice to lower the freezing temperature, literally down to the single digits or lower. But and that's all the more positive that we didn't get a lot of snow to have to and ice to melt off, because it wouldn't really happen at these temperatures. Although surprisingly, when the sun beats down, you know, you can get a little bit of slushiness even at frigid temperatures. But that's also a recipe for icing. You can also, when we got into this cold wave last night, there was a risk of a flash freeze with standing water, and that's a bad scenario too. I'm sure things tended to ice up, but that's where the crews, while temperatures were in the 20s, had a chance to do their work overnight and apply salt to handle for the morning commute when temperatures weren't quite as low. But you're right, at these readings, salt isn't going to do really any good at all.
Now, you said that it was blue skies out now. We're not expecting much snow until a few days from now. It looks like there's some snow flurries scheduled.
Yeah, there are, and I should mention, there are some bands of light snow showers that will come off Lake Michigan. In fact, it's snowing lightly around Marion. They'll kind of curl around. So we could see some snow showers during the course of the day, but little or no accumulation. Obviously, you can get an isolated snow squall and get a half inch, but for most of us, there won't be any real appreciable accumulation of snow, even if you do get an afternoon snow shower, typical lake effect. Now, the next chance of snow, which is what we call a little upper-level wave, not even a big storm, will come through Wednesday afternoon through Thursday morning. And that could be an inch or two of snow. We're not talking about anything major. Mm-hmm. And there could be a secondary wave behind that with a little snow or sleet Thursday night. But after that, it looks like the jet stream, the polar vortex, as we've been calling it, finally retreats to the north, and we should enjoy not only more seasonable weather, but even, you know, rather pleasant temperatures next weekend compared to what we're dealing with today.
Why do they call it a vortex?
Well, it's a huge swirl. Essentially, the core of the cold air, if you look at a weather map, it's like this giant counterclockwise circulating mass of cold air and with lower pressure near the center. So, and that is situated, usually it can be over Hudson Bay, it can be farther north, it can be part of what we call the Iceland-Greenland low. But in this case, it is really, at this time of year, of course, some of this is seasonal, it just expands. And when it expands far to the south, we get these historic or record-breaking cold patterns. And it's really not that uncommon. I think how far south it expands, in this case, this is farther south than what we usually see. But again, we have a history of some pretty some pretty serious Arctic blasts, even in the 1980s and 1990s, just that we haven't had very much of that in the last 15 years.
Right. Well, Ben Gelber, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ann. We'll talk more in detail on the news tonight on NBC4. 5, 6, and 11, so I'll crank out all the cold stats for everybody.
Sounds great. Ben Gelber, he's meteorologist, science and environmental reporter for WCMH, NBC4. Coming up, we'll take the temperature at the Ohio State House. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is a new year, but it's the second year of a two-year legislative session for the Ohio General Assembly and the last of 4 years in Republican John Kasich's first term as governor. So it's a little bit different perspective. And joining us now to put it in perspective, Mark Kovac, he's State House Bureau Chief for Dick's Newspapers and the Vindicator in Youngstown. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And also with us in the studio is Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Roland. Welcome back, Daryl.
It's great to be on the Polar Vortex edition of your show.
and that deep chuckling in the background, that is Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. She joins us by phone today because of the weather.
Indeed. Good morning.
Good morning. All right. So they're coming back to town when? Mark Kovac?
Oh, we have committee hearings scheduled for this week. I think maybe session days might be next week. Maybe they start out again, but we should, depending on the weather, get back into business here tomorrow with committee hearings and starting to move legislation again.
So, Daryl Roland, starting to move legislation, what are we really talking about here? It's different than it used to be in the old days. They don't move as much as they used to.
Generally speaking, that's right. First, I think we need to start out by underscoring our entire conversation has got to be colored by the fact that it's an election year,
right,
in Ohio. That means every representative is up for re-election, half of the Senate, and this year all the statewide executive offices,
right,
and two Supreme Court justices.
Okay.
So that is just going to color everything at the state house, as if it doesn't in all election years, but doubly so this year. Last year we passed a state operating budget. We're sort of back to more the traditional. This year we get a capital improvements bill. For the first time, we're actually going to have, for the first time in I think 6 years, we're going to have community projects, which are the goodies that community leaders really like to get their hands on. We're probably going to have what's called an MBR. Governor Kasich brought that abbreviation to us 2 years ago, the last off-budget year, because what he did in the budget wasn't enough. We have to have a mid-biennial review, which is some budget stuff, but mainly policy stuff done through the budget.
It's not unusual after an operating budget's passed that once or twice in the next year or two, there are touch-ups because things change. But this is different than that.
Right. This is not your budget corrections bill. This is like new policies, and it may not be as heavy as it was 2 years ago, but there's a lot of talk about needing to tweak the Ohio tax code even more than what's already happened. Fracking tax or severance tax. Mark referred to committee hearings. We'll have a second hearing on that scheduled for this week. We have, because of the Medicaid expansion, we have about $400 million in savings. There's a debate about what to do with that revenue. As always, there are election bills and other things. Peter Beck is scheduled to go to trial, a representative from the Cincinnati area, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. And we'll have some campaign finance filings at the end of the month that will tell us a lot about how Ed Fitzgerald is doing and whether he was able to raise money, even as the debacle with his erstwhile running mate, Senator Eric Kearney, was taking place. So it's a very important filing deadline at the end of this month. He's definitely going to be behind, I think, Governor Kasich, but we'll see how far behind. Hopefully, for his sake, he can still see the taillights.
Karen Kassler?
Yes.
What about, I mean, is there anything that's jumping out at you that we should be looking for in the near future?
Well, I think that MBR is really something to watch because, you know, it's going to certainly set some sort of tone or whatever for what Governor Kasich wants to do, and it will show a lot of how well he's getting along with some of the Republicans, because obviously there was a lot of concern over Medicaid expansion and a little bit of a split there. So I think that's going to be interesting to watch. Those are the main things that I'm watching, though, watching the same things that your experts there in the studio are.
We also have this public works bond issue that they're going to try to push on the ballot in May. We've got a first hearing on that this week, I believe, a $1.9 billion for more roads and bridges and money for local governments.
Okay. Now, has that been done before?
Yes. This would just be a renewal
of
something that started, I think, back in the 80s. A 10-year bonding program. I think it's about $150 million a year now. It would go to $175 the first 5 years, then to $200 million a year the final 5 years of that 10-year period.
And public works, not to be confused with local building projects.
Right, it's not the capital bill. It's a little confusing. Right. This is called the Statewide Capital Improvements Program. The reason Ohioans would vote, and we'll probably vote on it in the May primary, because Ohioans would put their, you know, the full faith and all that good stuff of the voters, of the taxpayers, behind these bonds that would be sold. So it's a bonded program. Your taxes will not go up directly because of it, but you're underwriting it, so to speak.
Okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Karen Kassler of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Mark Kovac from the Youngstown Vindicator, and also Daryl Rowland from the Columbus Dispatch. If you have a question or comment about what's happening at the state and state government and politics, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk a little bit about the biennial. No, it's the mid
biennial review.
Okay. Karen, refresh our memories. What happened? Was it 2 years ago? Yeah.
Yeah, that was. There's the budget. You know, the budget is a 2-year document, and so halfway through the budget, Governor Kasich in his first year decided that he wanted to make some changes, make some updates, that sort of thing. And the big thing he did in the first mid-biennium review is try to put the severance tax into the state budget. That was stripped out, but it started the whole battle over the severance tax. Right now, the governor tried a severance tax again with this budget. It was once again stripped out. Now, House leaders have proposed their own severance tax, which Governor Kasich says is not enough. But I'm wondering if we might get a severance tax proposal in that MBR, among other possible tax reform proposals. I mean, Governor Kasich has made it clear that cutting the income tax is a top priority. He wants to change the tax structure so that it's more reliant on sales taxes rather than income taxes. And so you could see some of that stuff coming in the MBR. The MBR is mostly technical, but certainly there are some things in there that will stand out.
They're saying that the, Mark Kovac, that the capital budget's coming back after 6 years because things are better. How are they measuring that? Are they that much better?
Well, I think that's open to interpretation. It depends on what you're looking at. I mean, Democrats continually point out jobs numbers and unemployment numbers, mm-hmm. and that the economy is not growing at the rate that it should be. Even Republicans and the governor, you know, mentioned these headwinds from Washington that are slowing down Ohio's economic recovery. So I think that's open to debate as far as are things that much better.
So, Daryl Rowland, is this then a little bit of that politics we were talking about maybe?
Well,
it's pretty common association
No question. I think, though, this is more of a black and white. The numbers are better in terms of state revenue. 2 years ago, 4 years ago, you know, we were really in the dumper in Ohio in terms of state revenue. So, again, we could this doesn't really reflect that much on the larger state economy other than, you know, money is really flowing back into state coffers, especially in comparison to 4 years ago. And indeed, it's more healthy than 2 years ago. So, again, we had capital budgets. What we did not have, which, you know, the big capital budgets funding things like here at Ohio State, prison improvements,
right,
what have you, to state buildings. What we did not have the last two times around was those goodies for local governments. This time, and again, they've adjusted the process this time where Governor Kasich, sort of going on the model for the higher ed capital budget, if you will, a couple of years ago, wanted to form regional groups and said, you guys work together, you prioritize what you want. So, for instance, here in Central Highway, the Columbus Partnership prioritized things, and that's where we are now. We had the list of priorities that has gone to the state, then, of course, the legislature and the governor will decide what gets it. But, you know, among those local priorities, for instance, are the work down at Veterans Memorial that's been proposed by the community. And that's probably the most, or that would be the biggest ticket item locally on that, I believe.
All right. So let's move to politics. What we've got, there has been a little action or lack thereof, I guess. We thought there was going to be a primary opponent for, or there might have been for the governor, but it looks like not, right, Mark?
Late Saturday, we got an announcement from Ted. How do you pronounce his last name? Is it Stephenoff or
Stephenoff.
We got this announcement late. We were supposed to have a press conference on Tuesday, mm-hmm. which was going to be kind of the rollout and the announcement late Saturday evening.
What happened? Does anybody know?
According to, I would think, now he says in his statement that it didn't have anything to do with the problems that were surfacing with his running mate.
Some overdue taxes or that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, we've kind of, we thought we'd heard that story once. But yeah, my colleague Joe Varden had a really good story last week talking about some of those same things that was happening to Mr. Stefano's running mate from up in the Mahoning Valley area. So, again, whether that was the same or not, but boy, it was sure, I'm running to, I'm no longer running within a matter of days.
Yeah.
And the bigger picture was, this got national news, because one of the things I think people really want to see, not only in Ohio and nationally, is, okay, Tea Party folks, you guys make a lot of noise, but what is your clout really at the polls? So this may have given us a good indication, someone who's completely unknown, but how much would that Tea Party label have gotten, you know, against an incumbent governor? That would have been really interesting.
And I think it's interesting to note that, too, because, you know, this Ted Stefano did not have a whole lot of time. He was going to announce tomorrow, and then the primary was going to be in May. He didn't have a whole lot of time to come up with a campaign structure, to raise money, to do all the things that he needed to do to win this primary or to at least make a good showing. And so I think that's really interesting to note that he decided he was going to run and then all of a sudden pulled back. I think that's, you know, there are going to be people who are going to read this as the Tea Party isn't as strong as they claim to be.
That's an observation that has existed since the existence of the Tea Party, such as it is that they pride themselves on not being organized, on not having, a statewide party and that sort of a thing. You just wonder, how in the world can you get elected, except at the more local level, perhaps, where there aren't as many votes at stake?
And if you talk to Tom Zostowski, who a Tea Party leader in Portage County, local coverage area,
he's
for
been
me,
on this show, yeah.
Yeah, who ran for Republican Party chairman, mm-hmm. Was defeated handily there. If you talk to him about the conferences and things that they have, they say, these are designed to try to get people at the local level involved, more involved in the political process and the decision making that's going on. And I thought at least the interesting part for me, having talked to Ted about those things, or Tom about those things, is he had a line in his statement that said, the two parties have pretty much made it impossible for a common person to run for political office in the state. I think that's kind of an interesting hook for me, that comes out of this, that, you just can't be a normal person off the street, come and run for office and think you're going to do well.
Well, I don't know if normal person and coming off the street are the same thing, but, you definitely can't come off the street. Yeah. You need to have an organization, Daryl. I mean, particularly in a state like Ohio, 7 major or 8 major media markets. And
not to be cynical, did that just dawn on him in the few days he was running for office? I mean, that's
exactly.
Been true probably
forever.
For 150 years at least in this state. Sure. And is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I'm not really commenting on that. It's just the reality of, to just walk in off the street, if you will, and run for statewide office. Well, you have the constitutional right to do that if you, get a minimal filing fee and get a few petition signatures. Sure, you have the right, but the reality is you will need a multimillion-dollar campaign, normally speaking.
Right. Ed Fitzgerald, he's announced to as a Democratic candidate. He's the one endorsed by the Democratic Party in Ohio. But there's an alternative.
Todd.
Maybe.
Right. He's done this before, right? It's Todd Portoon.
Right.
From Hamilton County Commissioner. Right. Kieran Kassler, like I said, he's done this before where he's toyed with people's emotions.
Well, and I think, he has some backing in Southwest Ohio from Stephen Reese, who is, I believe, the father of Alicia Reese, the state representative. Mm-hmm. And there's concern among some Democrats that Ed Fitzgerald is not the right candidate. And some are pointing to the whole rollout of Eric Kearney as his running mate and how that worked.
State Senator Eric Kearney, who then dropped out after about 2.5 weeks or so as his running mate.
Right. But certainly the Democratic Party has united itself behind Ed Fitzgerald. And so Todd Portoon starts out really with an uphill battle. I mean, his county party, the state party, has already said Ed Fitzgerald is their guy. And so if Portoon wants to try to take him on, he's going to be doing it without any sort of support or Sometimes a primary happens where no candidate is endorsed by the party. This time there is a candidate that is endorsed. And so it's going to be really challenging for him if he does intend to go forward with it. He has not filed yet, to my knowledge, so I don't know if he really will follow through with that. He may be talking about this to get the conversation going. I'm not really sure what his intentions are at this point.
He faces the same hurdles that Mr. Stephenow did before he dropped out.
Well, except that he certainly has some name recognition in Southwest Ohio as a longtime Hamilton County Commissioner. He's a legislator. He can point to his record on that. I mean, Ted Stephenow is known to Tea Party folks, and that's probably the extent of it, maybe. But either way, Todd Fortune definitely does have an uphill battle if he does want to run against Ed Fitzgerald.
There is a somewhat viable third-party candidate, Libertarian, this year. He's been a state representative before. Daryl, can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, and now when you say viable,
well,
he's not going to win. Yeah,
no.
But you know, the whole question here is, you know, in this case, in this equation, can he bloody up John Kasich enough where it will basically help Ed Fitzgerald? That's sort of the whole bottom line here. You know, he's not going to win, barring the biggest political miracle in Ohio history.
Yeah.
So the question is, and again, they're talking about maybe if he can pull off maybe 6%, and if Fitzgerald can make it close, you know, 6% in a politically balanced state can mean a lot. But we've got a long ways to go before we even get to making that.
And I should say, 6% would be historically insane in a way, because the Libertarian candidate has only gotten about, I think the most a Libertarian candidate has gotten has been around 2.5%. So, I mean, if he gets 6%, that's just a historical record for him to get. But it would certainly be the difference potentially between Fitzgerald and Kasich. I mean, between Strickland and Kasich, it was only 2 points.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you could really, a good third-party candidate who really bites into the Republicans' lead could definitely make a difference.
And if they could somehow get the support of all these disgruntled Tea Party folks, mm-hmm. you know, who have said publicly, you know, we don't need the governor's office. We have Republicans controlling the legislature. So, you know, we can still get
stuff
done.
And not only that, some of them don't embrace a lot of the issues that the Tea Party tends to embrace, a lot of social issues and so forth, but they want to, you know, they want less government control, not more when it comes to private issues.
Yeah,
again, part of the question, Ann, is just how mad are, you know, Tea Party folks, very conservative Republicans at Kasich? Their candidate, you know, their dream candidate is probably not going to be on the ballot or certainly not going to win. So are they so mad they will not vote for Kasich, even if it means putting a Democrat in the governor's mansion? So it's that's how the calculus runs here. And again, it's not about winning or my candidate's going to win or lose, but am I so upset, for instance, about the Medicaid expansion
mm-hmm.
or what have you, or that he hasn't endorsed the heartbeat bill more adamantly, or whatever my favorite issue is, well, I then withhold my vote from Governor Kasich, even though I may agree with him on a bunch of stuff.
Are any of you guys surprised at how narrow it is? Ed Fitzgerald, we've heard of him, but he certainly doesn't have, I mean, I know he's been to all 88 counties by now and that sort of thing, but still, I was surprised by 7 percentage points between them.
It's early.
Yes,
I mean,
it is early.
You know, we're talking about this because we live and breathe this
Kasich's
stuff.
Kasich's been in the office for 3 years.
And I think still even there are a lot of people that just aren't even, you know, aren't plugged in or aren't even thinking about it. Or, you know, we've got a lot of time. Ed Fitzgerald has a lot of time. And mm-hmm. Governor Kasich has a lot of time both to make their cases.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Then we'll return to our conversation about state government and politics with our band of reporters here. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking state government and politics with a panel of veteran Statehouse reporters. Karen Kassler of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau is joining us by phone. In the studio, Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch and Mark Kovac of the Youngstown Vindicator. If you have a question or comment, you can join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you want to check out our Facebook page, you can post your question or comment there as well. Someone mentioned that Republicans will resume pushing a number of bills to change Ohio's election laws. What's going to happen first? I mean, is everything going to get through, or are there top priorities, Daryl Rowland?
One of the things that have really bugged Republicans for years now is the so-called Golden Week, and that's a week at the basically at the end of September, early October, where two things happen. It's the final week where you can actually register to vote, but it's also the first week then where you can cast an early absentee ballot. So you can go in and register and vote, and it's not quite a one-step. One-stop shopping process, but close enough. Republicans say we don't like that.
Why don't they like it?
There's a lot of talk about potential for fraud. And frankly, bipartisan elections officials are reluctant to have this as well. Now, Democrats would respond, say, you talk a lot about fraud, but there's not that much evidence.
And Republican sort of compared John Husted, the Secretary of State, said very little evidence.
Right. Of big picture. Although, you know, this thing, I think it's more of an elections practice. They don't necessarily like having this all happen at the same time to say it's just not a best practice. The other area, and that's one piece of legislation. The other main piece of legislation is about, again, early voting. Can anyone other than John Husted, or whoever Secretary of State, mail out unsolicited absentee ballot applications? Because as you know, in the past in Ohio, Franklin County and other counties, usually the big counties, have sent them out. Now, critics say, hey, those are Democratic areas. You're going to be soliciting in Democratic areas. Guess what? You got more absentee ballots than get Democratic areas. Why not Republican areas? So should it be all or none? Or, you know, John Husted has taken it upon himself to actually send the applications out statewide. Yeah, he did in the last statewide election. But the legislature may want to end that practice, or at least certainly they control the purse strings for future mailings. Sort of saying, don't do it unless we specifically give you the money, which again could all be political. And again, why is this important? Because again, bottom line, Democrats tend to like to vote early. And Republicans like to vote on Election Day, especially if you compare the early in-person versus Election Day polling. So, hey, my side likes it this way, so I'm going to support my side doing it, and too bad about your side.
And both of those bills that Daryl mentioned have already moved through the Senate. They're sitting in the House, you know, waiting for final votes. The other one that we're hearing a lot more chatter on is online voter registration. The state already allows you to go in online and update your registration information. It seems like everybody wants, or not, obviously it hasn't passed, so not everybody, but you hear Republicans and Democrats, Secretary of State, all talk about how let voters register online and cut down on fraud and, you know, make polls more accessible to people. So that's something else that seems to be moving.
Mm-hmm. And on those bills, Republicans and Democrats both have their reasons for why they support it. For example, on the bill that will shorten the early voting window, you have some Republicans who are saying, hey, the early voting window is so long that you could potentially cast a ballot in a presidential election before the debates are even on television. And perhaps that's too early, and they've been raising that as one of the possible arguments. On the Secretary of State sending out the unsolicited absentee ballot applications, the idea that they keep talking about is uniformity, where every voter is treated the same, so that you, if you live in one district, you're not, or one county, you're not treated differently than another. And those are the kind of arguments we hear, but I think Daryl's right on in the whole idea of, it's my side, I'm going to support what my side wants to do because it'll help my side bring in voters.
So which side has enough votes to get through what they want? I guess the legislature is soundly controlled by Republicans.
Supermajority in the House, yes. So I don't think there's going to be any problem if they really want one of these bills to go through. I mean, certainly Democrats are going to protest and the debate, as it has been in anything that's been a party line vote this past year, very passionate. But, you know, if the Republican supermajority wants to do it, it's going to get done.
But they're going to have to move them quickly, I think, before the end of the month in order to be in
March.
Yeah, to be in place for May, the May,
May
primary. Yeah. So you'd think if they were going to do something, it'd be coming soon.
Right. Although the big game, of course, is in the fall for the, you know, things like Golden Week and things of that nature. I think, again, they not to be the old cynic here again, but you know, the bottom line is, sure, there's no question Republicans have the votes to do this. But there will be a political calculation made. It's like, okay, does this make us look so bad? Here are, you know, the cynics will say, here are Republicans yet again, you know, pushing back on Ohioans' right to vote. You know, is that, you know, contributing to that image, that stereotype, some may say?
And do they want to be going into an election year with that?
With that on their back.
Right.
I mean, is that going to outweigh? Well, but it really will help us. So somebody's got to put those on the scales and weigh it out.
Well, all right. So let's look at that middle, the libertarians, the Tea Party groups. Is this something that matters to them?
Well, certainly the bill on minor party candidates does matter to them.
Yep.
And you've got the Libertarian Party. I believe they're going to be in court sometime this week. They're trying to stop the implementation of that law that would put new rules on minor party candidates. So absolutely, that matters to them.
Yes, and again, cynics refer to that as the John Kasich Reelection Protection Act. So, again, you know how that's being looked at.
Okay. Let's turn to some predict that the Ohio Senate will look at legislation in 2014 that would make big changes to the state's concealed weapons laws. Do you think that's likely in an election year? I guess including the so-called stand your ground self-defense provision, which is yet to be enacted in Ohio. The old cynic Darryl Rowland.
Guaranteed there will be gun bills brought before the legislature.
There will be bills, but
passage, again, it's going to be a political calculation. It's the Republican dream right now with the margins they have in the legislature and a governor of your own party. It's almost like, what do you want? So it does become more of a political calculus. Like, okay, how far can we go? You know, again, in general, Republicans enjoy strong support from the gun rights community. So, but how far are we going to go? We've trimmed away the concealed carry restrictions. Again, how far do you want to go? Again, stand your ground, very controversial. But hey, if that'll make my supporters happy, as opposed to the other person's supporters, maybe it's an equation. Again, I'll take the political hit because bottom line is it's a net win for me.
David in Worthington, you're on the air. You're going to bring up an issue that's been dealt with many, many times before, but why not one more time? Go ahead.
Yeah, why do people who have sworn allegiance to protect and defend the Ohio Constitution, this would be law enforcement, the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, the Supreme Court, allow the legislature to break the Constitution by having more than one topic in their bills? And I don't think that the media does repeatedly address this topic. If nothing else, you could at least say one sentence every time you describe a vote that this bill has now been passed and it has multiple topics in it, making it unconstitutional.
But
thank you.
Yeah, thank you, David, for the call. That's obviously been brought up before. It's not a new topic, not a new issue. But what it comes down to interpretation, right, Mark?
Oftentimes, and it's always fascinating to me when there's a floor debate on something, you know, and somebody really doesn't want it to pass. I'll always bring up the single subject issue. You're like, oh no, this isn't a single issue. This is multiple issues, and it does come up constantly.
And no one ever says anything in response.
No.
To my recollection.
Well, this is one of those. Okay, it's like it's illegal for you to drive over the speed limit too. But until someone pulls you over and gives you a ticket, you'll probably continue to do it. And you know, every so often, someone's going to file a court challenge, and the court will probably shoot them down. Now, again, this, you go back to the old timers, the old legends, you know, former Speaker Vern Reif, former Senate President Dick Finan, and they talk, you know, well, sure, that's just one subject. It's the budget. It's spending. Or I think one of them even said, well, it all deals with state government.
Right. So I've heard that.
Like, it's like, the caller, and you know, you mentioned the media. There's a good point where maybe we don't point this out enough. But I don't think you really want us judging when it is subjective, saying, well, this crosses the line, this doesn't, at least not in a news story.
Right.
But it's probably a topic that is worth a little bit more attention from us. Yeah, we're kind of guilty as charged, perhaps.
Daniel, in Clintonville, you're on the air. You're wondering about fracking legislation.
Yes, I've been a bit disturbed by the environmental position of the state government, not just the Kasich administration, but... Everyone, it seems that it's a bit short-sighted not to be imposing a tax. We're already dealing with brownfields from 20 and 30 years ago. We're going to have brownfields and brown waters because of all the pollution.
So you're talking about the severance tax then, right? Daniel, you're talking about the severance tax, right?
The severance tax,
okay.
Yeah. Why they haven't imposed that yet.
All right.
Well, it's... like I said earlier, it was in Governor Kasich's first version of the budget. It was stripped out by Republican lawmakers who feel that it could potentially damage the industry as it's developing. They have now proposed their own version of the severance tax, and Governor Kasich has said that it's not enough. He appreciates that they are at least talking about it, but what the House leadership has proposed on this is not enough. So it's he keeps saying, too, that he's wondering that if a new severance tax doesn't pass that is reasonable, in his word, then maybe there will be a group that will put it on the ballot before voters, which could be very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, it was, you know, the two times we've gone around this before is, you know, the MBR 2 years ago and in the governor's original budget proposal. It's been an interesting scenario where the Kasich administration comes out with all these arguments in favor of a tax increase, you know, comparing it with other states and, you know, the usual measures. And it's like, you are a Republican still, right? It's interesting when the leopard changes his spots, if you will, just for this one issue. But that's the case certainly that the governor and his supporters make, that we're not going to drive these guys out of business by...
They're here because they can dig something out of the ground.
Yeah. It's like, so you're either going to come here to dig it out of the ground, it's not, you know, or you're going to leave. And, okay, there's other states that has it as well, but if Ohio's... you know, deposits are like all the testings are showing they are, you know, that little bit of tax, the proponents argue, is not going to hurt anything in this. And yeah, there's certainly still lots of environmental, lots of land use type questions. There's questions about this bill. It's sponsored by the industry, if you will. Was it written by the industry? Well, that's something, again, the public and we reporters, we can't get at because that's not a public record. But there's a lot of suspicions about this, but maybe it's one that will actually pass.
Okay. All right. Anything else? We've got about a minute. There's all kinds of things. I mean, red light cameras.
Mark Dan makes his return to Columbus this week on Wednesday.
Goodness gracious, our former attorney general who left office in disgrace.
Having oral arguments before the Supreme Court on a mortgage case, I think. That should be fascinating.
Probably pack the Supreme Court if nothing else better is going on.
It might be interesting to see who's in that audience, huh?
All right. Well, I want to thank you Mark Kovac, State House Bureau Chief of Dix Newspapers and the Vindicator of the Youngstown. Thanks for joining us today.
Stay warm out there.
And Karen Kassler on the phone with us. She's the Bureau Chief at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks, Karen.
You're welcome. Stay warm.
Thanks. You too. Daryl Rowland, Public Affairs Editor at the Columbus Dispatch. Daryl, thanks for joining us again.
Always enjoying it, Ann.
Okay. Look for us next Monday at 10 a.m. for our Reporters Roundtable. And thanks for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.